Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is part four of A Time for Heroes, the conclusion of our recounting of the 1994 season. I'm Michael Adams, here with a very happy Andrew Paskin as he relives the glory days of his Canberra Raiders.
How you going, mate? I've been waiting for this episode since the first one.
Well, let's start there with the build-up. On our last episode, we talked about you feeling very nervous going into this game, which Canberra ended up winning quite easily. Can you remember any of your thoughts? Why you thought Canberra might struggle?
Well, I just thought that Canberra had a really good side, and they'd just beaten us recently. And I think that was the start of my ongoing anxiety issues as well. I just remember I wasn't overconfident, put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mentioned that I actually thought Canberra. I had no doubts in my mind that Canberra were going to win, despite that semi-final win by Canterbury.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I logically thought they should win.
Yeah,
but I wasn't going like this is a fait accompli.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny that reading about the build-up, in the press there was a lot of the sentiment that Canberra would struggle having played like three really bruising semi-finals. Canterbury would benefit from the week off. Within the Canberra environment, though, there was a real unspoken air of confidence. Mal, Laurie Daly, all the key players in the game have spoken about going into that game not really having any doubts that they were going to win.
Looking back at it, objectively, why would they?
Yeah, yeah.
They both had three grand final appearances, half the squad.
Yeah.
Then they had the best run of the year, 93, until Ricky Short's injury. Mm. Why wouldn't they be confident?
Yeah. And the fact that it was Mal's last game also had that extra bit of not pressure, but just like, we're winning this game. You know, yeah, we're not going to lose this game.
But in saying that, Lomax was a major part of their enforcement.
Yeah.
And as usual, he was suspended.
So Brian Smith, for instance, came out and said Canberra are a jaded football side. They're on the ropes, you know. And I think that kind of played into Canberra. If anything else, it gave them that underdog status when they so clearly didn't deserve it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to read this out as well. This is a Danny Widler piece from Rugby League Week.
Must be early Widler.
Yeah, yeah. So he said, Canterbury coach Chris Anderson has one message for his Dogs of War this week. Beware the wounded champion. I wasn't following rugby league media as closely as you were in this era. So when we started this show and you mentioned the Dogs of War trope and how often it came up, I didn't realize how often it came up. Like it was
hourly.
It was crazy reading the stories from this year, from 1994, seeing how often Dogs of War was alluded to.
Yeah.
Like, it is a great name, I understand it, but like...
Well, I mean, it's the nature of the beast. It's always the low-hanging fruit in rugby league stories.
And now, 25 years later, we still haven't gotten away from it. So, the other thing in Canberra's favour was their coach, Tim Sheens, who, we didn't get a chance to talk about when we talked about Canberra's squad. Has Tim Sheens almost become underrated as a coach?
I really think so. I don't know how it's happened.
Yeah.
I mean, look at his record.
Yeah, yeah. I think part of it is that the idea that like anyone could have coached that Canberra team to a comp, which I don't know how valid that argument is, but his record is probably undermined by the fact that he had such a champion team.
I think the Tigers thing goes away to solving that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
But you're right. But I mean, Jesus, like, if you had a bad coach, they wouldn't have won it.
Yeah. So I think like his record should speak for itself, but it seems to not. I don't think anyone blames him for the Cowboys. Like, he was never going to, like, you know, do much with that squad.
I mean, that's the only place he hasn't had success.
Yeah.
Really.
Mm.
Australia did well, you know. I think the Blues didn't do so well. But...
Well, he never really got a good shot at New South Wales. Like, he was kind of like one and done.
I think people in the know he's an all-time great coach. Mm. And I think the public underrated him.
Yeah. And it's so funny. Like, he kind of like wore out his welcome as a coach. Like, he probably stayed at the Tigers too long. I think he definitely stayed at the Tigers too long.
Yeah.
Like, he probably should have, like, bailed a bit earlier. And it got to the point where when it was clear that he was leaving the Tigers, there was talk of him coming to St. George. And I remember going, oh, Tim Sheens?
Yeah.
And now I'm like, Tim Sheens, like, won multiple premierships. He, like, had success at every level of the game. Like, wouldn't have been a bad get, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very good point. I think he's definitely underrated.
Mm. But so going into that week, that grand final week, a lot of the Canberra players spoke about Tim Sheens' ability to calm everyone down and get everyone's mind focused on the job, cut out the distractions.
But not just this. He had 89, 90, 91, the salary cap issues. Like, they had, like, experience and toughness, yeah, all yeah. of them.
But so Laurie Daly said this. After a tough 22-9 preliminary final win over North Sydney, Tim gave us a couple of days off to rest and recover, and our normal Tuesday night training session was simply used as a team meeting in which he told us what he expected from us against Canterbury. Control the ball, he said, and it was good advice. It's so funny with rugby league coaches. The most rudimentary, like, fundamental advice can, you know, be like this, like, winning edge.
Like, the best one ever, it always works. Origin. He just said to rip in. We ripped in, we won.
But it's so funny because, like, I think every coach would say that same thing. So why do you believe some coaches that you need to rip in and other coaches, you're like, I don't know, do we need to rip in?
But that's what I'm saying. Like, he knows exactly what was needed because he's been there so many times.
Yeah.
Like, well, we don't need to train tonight. If we do, it's going to waste our energy and blah, blah, blah. Give him some time to play some golf.
Mm.
And it works
because yeah.
he knows.
And I think that is true of all of the great coaches. They know when to, you know, put the hammer down, when to relax, when to, you know, it all comes down to that individual man management, doesn't it?
I remember about 10 years ago, Wayne Bennett was the master of knowing when to peak for a long season, and other coaches hadn't worked it out.
Yeah.
And they were like fizzling out in round 16. And Wayne Bennett's going, no, you peak at the grand final. So,
I wonder if, you know, Melbourne went through like a, you know, fairly long drought when you look at, you know, the start of their premiership run or grand final run in 2006. So they won their first legitimate comp in 2012. Went through that 4 or 5 years where they were consistently top four, consistently going deep into the semis, but not getting it done. And remember over that period, they seemed to always do well over the Origin period. I wonder if Bellamy maybe was worried too much about maintaining their momentum during Origin rather than like looking at the finish line.
I think he definitely worked it out later, the long season.
Yeah.
So someone's told him to control the ball and not so many words, but he's done so.
So let's talk about grand final day. And as we usually do when we discuss a grand final, before we get on to the main event, we talk about the entertainment. This year's grand final entertainment featured a duo of Tommy Emmanuel and Olivia Newton-John. That's a good get, right?
It is good.
All I did was sing the national anthem. Like, you have Tommy Emmanuel, one of the great guitarists, just playing Advance Australia Fair on an acoustic guitar.
Can I just give Olivia a bit of credit here? I think she's the bigger draw than Tommy Emmanuel.
I was that's why I started with Tommy. You know?
We've got Leonardo DiCaprio and Joe Camilleri.
So you get Olivia Newton-John in to sing the national anthem. Like,
it's crazy.
It's so crazy that they thought that was a good use of those talents, and the actual grand final entertainment was a celebration of the four new clubs with, you know, themed floats for each of those teams.
In that era, they were forever driving open-top cars around the ground.
Yeah, it was the era of thousands of kids wearing color-coded T-shirts, breaking off into sections of the field. It's so funny because that really was how grand final entertainment was thought of in that era. It was almost like an Olympics closing ceremony.
Yeah, it was.
It was kind of
way worse.
Yeah. So I can't really like knock them for it. But I mean, you did have Tina Turner the year before singing Simply the Best live on stage. So they understood something of the fact that you could...
I just can't believe you have Olivia Newton-John there in that era and say, do you want to sing Xanadu as well?
Yeah.
Maybe a few Grease numbers. I mean, you're here.
Yeah.
Well, you have the microphone.
You know, Koala Blue's not doing too well. You could probably use the extra lorry. So that's how it went down. So I'll read the description of the floats for those four new clubs just to paint the picture. So this was Darren Hadland describing it. The Auckland Warriors, South Queensland Crushers, Western Reds and North Queensland Cowboys all shared the stage at the Sydney Football Stadium on Rugby League's biggest day. Highlighted by a country hoedown, this was a foot-stomping introduction to Rugby League 1995 style. There were Maori Warriors laying down the challenge, the Reds sailing in on their yachts and the Crushers on their gravy train. But the Cowboys stole the show. They rode into town on their wooden cows as the New South Wales Rugby League stepped aside for the Australian Rugby League to take over the Winfield Cup. In season past, the league occasionally has put the show ahead of the football, but this year was different. Everything had a football flavour to it.
In what year did they put the show ahead of the football?
The last time we talked about grand final entertainment, it was the Australian Navy doing a bridge building exercise. So I don't think they were known for putting...
What year was it again?
That was 87.
That's right.
But again, we go back and forth on the importance of the grand final entertainment, and in the end, no one cares, no one remembers it. So let's move to the game.
But you know what I loved about that era of Winfield Cup grand finals was the build up during the week when you go to the local area, the local Sydney suburb,
yeah,
and they had the butchers would be dressed up,
yeah, yeah.
And Belmore was just like that,
yeah.
This year,
mm.
The bakers had blue and white bread and, you know, food coloring and whatever. Down in Canberra as well. Mm. So cool. And then they crossed at a Leeds club all day through all the grades, and they'd be getting drunker and drunker and screaming. And
That's on my run sheet too, because those two things were always my favourite thing about grand final day.
I was so jealous that I couldn't go to the Leeds club.
Yeah. Like, I remember the first time I remember was 88, Canterbury Balmain,
yeah,
where the news that week, they do the like cross to Norton Street or you know, yeah, Darling Road, wherever they'd be, and it'd be like black and orange. And then
it'd be Laurie Nicholls there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was so cool. And yeah, the crosses to the Leagues Club. But like watching this grand final and looking at the crosses to Canberra Leagues Club, I remember seeing like this guy, I watched this guy like just taking a big drag on a cigarette inside the Leagues Club. And I was like, how do we put up with that for so long?
Do you know who started the ball and getting rid of smokes? Rodney Rood.
Yeah?
He used to bar cigarettes from his own shows because he was doing 2,000 shows a year.
Yeah.
And he started banning ciggies in his, and he was one of the first.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay, there you go. Wow, I didn't know that.
One of the great men. I actually had my own Leagues Club style celebration in my own house in Toronto. So I invited my nan to come up, and my dear auntie Denise, who's recently passed, to come up to our house. It was me, mum and dad, and nan and Denise. And I had the paper mache streamers,
yep,
around the roof, yep, around the ceiling,
mm.
Balloons and everything. Like, what a fruit.
I did the exact same thing. Like, that was my grand final tradition. No matter who was playing, I'd get the streamers of one team, because I'd always have some team that I hated or some team to go for. So I had the green, and the good thing about Canberra is all green, but you add some yellow, add some blue, you just pick other colours that you can get the streamers of, as long as it's primarily green.
But my poor mum, like I said, oh, I'm going to decorate the place. Yeah. So who ended up decorating? I might have blown up three balloons. Yeah. I'm kicking some rolled up socks through some imaginary goalposts.
But yeah, I love grand final day.
It's so cool. Like this, yeah. So this is the last one I got to have with my nan.
It was
real special to me.
Mm. Let's talk about the game itself. Just some opening thoughts. I'd say not a classic grand final, but a highly entertaining one.
I can't really comment objectively on it. Definitely entertaining.
Yeah.
It's wildly entertaining. But when it's your team, you can't look at it properly.
No. Yeah, very true.
Obviously, it wasn't close. So
yeah. No. When it's your own team, it comes down to did you win or did you lose. The rest you don't really worry about.
Well, the quality of the football, I think, was very entertaining. But like, I think everyone wants a tight grand final.
Yeah.
Everyone remembers Broncos, Cowboys.
Yeah. But it was a pleasure to watch. It was a pleasure to sit through it again, as we did, you know, in the last couple of weeks. So I thought, like, we just go, you know, having recently watched the game, we just give some of our random observations of the game. Yeah. Do you want to get us going? Is there anything that stands out for you?
Yeah, I remember just being really really nervous for kickoff and everything. And then there was like a drop ball.
Well, let's start there with the famous drop ball. Martin Bella off the opening kickoff drops it. And really, like, it's funny, like in hindsight, like that mightn't have had an effect. But it happened, and suddenly it's like from the moment of that drop, the game was over.
At the time, I felt sorry for him. And I feel even more so now, because he's synonymous with like gaffes and brain explosions, but he was such a good player.
Mm. Well, Terry Lamb actually like put his hand up and said that Bella's eyesight's not that good, so Terry Lamb usually takes that kickoff, and for whatever reason there was a breakdown of communication, so he kind of wore the blame and said it wasn't really Bella's fault.
Either way, you got to catch the first kickoff of the grand final.
Mm. Another pre-game blunder was the coin toss, with the decision of Canterbury to go against the wind, which is a common trope in that era of rugby league, people like thinking they'll run against the wind and hope to, you know, make the most of it in the second half.
I never understood that. Not being a qualified meteorologist, I'm not sure this is accurate, but like, what if the wind's not there in the second half?
Which seems to be whatever. You're tempting fate when you do that. Like, it seems like any time a team does that, the wind drops and they get no benefit. But I really like Tim Sheen's quote about it. He said, "We got to run the way we wanted. none of us could pick the wind anyway. It's like, exactly, you can't pick the wind, so just take it out of the equation. Unless it's like, you know, there's a cyclone blowing through, you know, take it out of the equation. And just...
It took Sheensy to clarify that.
So while we're just giving our own observations, I want to talk a bit about the commentary. Like, Phil Gould was such a standout on the day. Like, I thought he was sensational.
I watch this once a year, this anyway, myself, but it's been maybe one or two years since I saw this game. And in preparation for this, we watched it again. We both said it almost the same time. How good was Phil Gould?
Yeah.
It just makes me sick that we've missed out on this brilliant analysis just due to his personality.
Yeah, I know.
There was no sort of megalomania. There was no arrogance. It was just genius analysis.
He was so perceptive, so prescient. Like, the amount of times he'd basically say what was about to happen, and then it had happened like seconds later.
It's one of those things where he was match fit in coaching.
Yeah.
So he's one step ahead of the play. Mm. It was like in comedy, if you're doing gigs every night, you seem to be on top of everything before it happens.
Yeah.
And God, it was good.
And this is going to be an ongoing discussion throughout the season, but I wonder if it was Super League that ruined him, because that undoubtedly made him in terms of his position in the game.
I think so. I think it definitely did. It elevated him into a different... It was just a rugby league playing coach.
Yeah.
And then it becomes some sort of border somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Just by taking it heaps of money.
Yeah. So, yeah, like, it's a real loss, the commentator we could have had to what we ended up with.
He was definitely the standout, but the others were great as well. Sterling, straight off the bat as a commentator, he was so professional and so... He's an amazing analyst.
Yeah.
Underrated still, in my view.
Yeah.
And Fatty with the funniness and Rabs is the greatest ever. It was a great team.
Gary Belcher was... I never really rated him. I thought he's always been very wooden, and I don't think he ever really had much to offer.
I think that's why Badger's no longer in the TV.
But concert. He had a long run, eh?
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to say about Ray Warren, at one point when Canberra were running up a score, Gary Belcher actually posited, I wonder what the grand final record winning score is. Ray Warren said, I'll get that statistic. Like, as if it wasn't known. Like, it's just so, like, weird to me that, like, no one in that team, like, knew off the top of their heads that it was, like, the 75 grand final.
Yeah.
Especially since, like, the White Boots is, like, one of the three rugby league stories to ever get any airtime. And, like, Ray Warren, like, you know, up until a decade ago, like, you have a blue stripe on your black boot and he'll bring up White Boots 75, you know?
I think he's just caught off guard there, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
But that was very odd to me that wouldn't have just been rattled off.
Because he knows every other stat in the game. So I think he's just caught. I better ask Mido.
Yeah.
What if Mido was there then?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably. I love the grand final fashion. I thought Sean McRae was particularly fetching in his, like, King G shorts and, you know, and cap. Like, I think I said to you off air, he looked like he won a fan contest to run the water that day.
I should have had a word to his missus.
About Sean McRae, because he effectively had the same look when he finally got a first grade gig at South, you know, a decade plus later.
That Mr. Belvedere style look.
Yeah. I think you were never going to make it as a first grade coach looking like that.
No, it's weird that you're coaching athletes and you're sort of unathletic.
Yeah. John Lomax in his leather jacket was another fashion standout for me.
He looked like he'd just been tossed out of a nightclub. Like the John Lomax on the sideline was peak John Lomax.
Yeah. The last fashion point I had was the Canberra jerseys. Like, I think, in my view, that's the best jersey they ever had.
Quintessential.
They got the colour exactly right. Like, for a few years, like, there'd always be, like, a fluctuating either a little bit dark, a little bit lighter. I think those jerseys were perfect.
Well, the 89 grand final one was too sort of, like, army-ish.
Yeah.
Too light and disgusting looking.
Mm.
And then you had some... too bright in various incarnations. That was the perfect hue.
Yeah, I think so too. But I also, looking at their current uniform, which I think is very good, I really like this year's jerseys. And it's a very similar colour scheme to what they had in 94. But I don't think the 94 jerseys would work today, like that exact shade. Like, it seems like something you need a matte finish for. And with the slick, shiny jerseys these days.
It was a jersey of its time.
Yeah, I think so too. It's kind of like the Para ones, where they've got the perfect... pattern, the perfect kind of color scheme with the thin stripes, but when you do it in the gold, it doesn't quite work with the modern shiny jerseys.
Agreed. Yeah, it was a heavy cotton twill color. It was Greg McCallum's final grand final.
Mm.
and he went out a winner.
Yeah.
But he was wearing my favorite ever TNT referee's uniform, the pale orange.
That was the classic one for me too.
Awesome.
Yeah.
They're all good, but...
I like the orange much more than the red.
I seem to remember that McCallum was in orange quite a bit. Mm. What if he just held up a whole bunch of orange ones?
Yeah.
And he had red as well.
Yeah.
But in the pale blue and the pink was also good.
Yeah. Great game. Great beard, McCallum. One of the great rugby league beards.
He was a referee that you could set your clock to, though. Mm. He wasn't going to be stood over, but he wasn't going to be a lair himself.
Who would you, if you had to pick one, Mick Stone or Greg McCallum, who would you go? I go Stone. I always like Stone.
Stone was late 80s.
Yeah.
McCallum was more your early 90s. And then your hero and mentor, Bill Harrigan, come in and took over.
So let's talk about Canberra's dominance, because from that opening kickoff, they were, you know, just an unstoppable steam train. One of those unstoppable forces was Noah Andruku.
Gave him his life.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about trying to turn it on as well.
Oh, absolutely. But he made that like 60-meter or so run early in the game, went blind, ran down the touchline, gets tackled like inches from touch. And again, you so rarely see it these days, someone taking the sideline on like that.
Yeah, it was amazing.
But for good reason. Like, I think if he tries that today, like, you know, he's in the front row.
Yeah, absolutely. It just wasn't that common to be smashed over the sideline.
Yeah,
like that,
yeah.
Especially if someone that strong.
Yeah.
But it was the nonchalance of him getting tackled like a millimeter from the touchline. No one mentions it.
Yeah.
He just gets up and plays it like nothing happened.
I know.
Like he was never going to be thrown out, but he was very, very close to getting thrown out.
Another early highlight in the game was Terry Lamb getting absolutely belted by Mal Meninga.
One of the most underrated hits in grand final
history,
because that rattled him to the core.
Yep.
And he was staggering around.
Yeah, like the game was basically over at that point. Like, he played so little part in the rest of that first half.
So we're talking about Ellery Hanley to this day, bar smashing him out of the game, and Mal did the same thing. Karma Police, and no one talks about it.
No. And it was a legal hit.
Legal, but he just enveloped him.
Yeah. But one of the funny things about the dominance of Canberra is most of their tries came off the back of Canterbury errors, like either, you know, directly from an error or from the ensuing set.
Well, but that's what a great team does. It forces errors just to the fear, and then it capitalizes when it has a chance.
Yeah.
The most noticeable thing for me was Stewart and Daly. They had the ball on an absolute string. As I said in episode two, they covered nearly the width of the field in two passes.
Yeah.
It's unstoppable.
But the other striking thing about the two of them on the day was how little both of them had to do, really. Like, I think they, you know, they probably could have, like, got by with, you know, having one of them out or, like, you know, like, they weren't dominant. They weren't, they didn't need to be dominant.
The confidence is more than anything.
Yeah.
So, we saw in 93 what happens when Stewart's out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and Daly, you know, turned it on when he had to.
It's funny, Daly, how the memory works. Like, in my mind, Daly, like, you know, was crawling like 10 meters out from the try line, you know, as if he's crossing no man's land. You know, it was like this slow motion crawl, but it, in reality, it was just, you know, he gets down and, you know, a couple of, you know, steps on his knees and he puts the ball down.
Yeah, good try though.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a quintessential grand final try.
Mm, yeah.
It's not a try you put in the great grand final tries of all time, but it's one you think about as a grand final try.
Absolutely. I think part of that was like how easily transferable it was to the promos.
Yeah.
Like, it just slotted right into the next year's Simply the Best, and it was just, you know, like a perfect moment.
Absolutely. While we're on tries, let's talk about Negus's effort.
Yeah.
Poetry in motion.
I know he had some really stiff competition, but watching that game, I was like, how did he miss the tour?
I think he was just a bit too young.
Yeah.
Inexperience-wise. So, just guys in front of him.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was good enough. And he wouldn't let anyone down.
Yeah, as I said, some really stiff competition, but, you know, like, you got to have a bolter.
You certainly do.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's talk about number 46, Paul Osborne. One of the great grand final stories that I don't think we're talking about anywhere near enough.
It deserves an episode on its own.
Yeah.
Being the worst judge in football history, I'm there as a 14-year-old going, why is he picking Paul Osborne? He doesn't even play. What a dummy. Like, we're missing John Lomas. I was freaking out. I'm like, he's gonna be a liability. They're going to be running around him. He's too slow. You know.
Well, you're by no means the only person to think that, which I'll get to. But let's just set up Paul Osborne for a moment. So he played in St. George for a number of years, had never made a semi-final series with them, goes to Canberra. St. George go on to make two grand finals in his absence, the 2 years that Canberra bombed in the finals. At mid-season 1993, he was basically told that he didn't have a place in Canberra's future. He was too old, too slow. This is the crazy thing to me. He was 27 in 1993.
He looked about 45.
I know, it's crazy. But so he was basically told, like, the games pass you by, cameras pass you by. If we make the grand final, you're not going to be in the squad. So he went to Tim Sheens and said, what can I do? And Sheen said, oh, you got to work on your speed, you know, make a few changes, which he duly did and got back into the team. Of course, there was not going to be a grand final appearance in 1993. But so 1994, he did get back into the team, but basically the same thing happened. Some younger, stronger, bigger, better players came along. He spent most of the back half of the season in reserve grade and was told that there'd be no place for him in the team in 1995. And this time there was to be no reprieve, so he had to make other plans. So he was all set to pack his bags and head off to England. He landed a deal with Featherstone and had his bags packed before the grand final to head out there and end his playing tenure with Canberra. Lo and behold, John Lomax gets sent off and Tim Sheen said, we may need you, you can't get on that plane.
Was it an SOS?
Well, I think you've got to be on the plane for it to be an SOS. I think if you're still, you know, in the squad, it's not an SOS. But so he had a decision to make. Do I take a chance, like possibly when you had Wesley, when you had Hetherington, a, you know, possibly unlikely chance of getting a grand final appearance? Do you take that over some security, a chance to play football and, you know, go out with a, you know, a good couple of years to end your career?
See, this is the part that's overlooked. Even I've forgotten about that part. I mean, it's a real sliding doors moment.
Yeah, so it truly was. And after delaying his decision with Featherstone and buying more time, he eventually said, I'm going to stay, lost his deal with Featherstone, and at that point was no certainty to make the grand final squad.
I wonder how much of Sheens' decision was impacted by the fact that he sacrificed like that.
I actually think very little. I don't think Sheens would have been sentimental about it.
Yeah, I agree with that as well, but like, I don't know. At the time, it was like, David Wesley's a great player.
Yeah. I think it all came down to the game plan Sheens had in mind. But it was a massive question mark. And, you know, you said you were going, what is he doing? Osborne's own teammates were saying the same thing. So in the aftermath, you had, you know, Laurie Daly in his book saying, you know, Ozzy produced 20 minutes of gold for us that day, on and on. And then Mal Meninga in his book saying, Tim pulled off a masterstroke in the grand final with his decision to use Paul Osborne. So a lot of praise in the aftermath. But at the time, this quote comes from a video special that Big League put out, which you can find on YouTube from a few years ago. So the video is called Big League, the Grand Final Hero, which is, it goes for about 4 minutes and it's absolutely brilliant. And I'm just going to read this quote from Tim Sheens. After the suspension, I had to make a decision as to who was coming in. Anyway, I grabbed the senior guys. That would be Mal, Laurie, Ricky, Steve Walters, I think, from memory. And we went into a private box there at Bruce. And I said, look, John's out. We're going to have to pick someone to start. What are your thoughts? Different players were thrown up. Brett Hetherington was favourite. He sort of played off the bench for John anyway. But I said, no, I want to go to Paul Osborne. There was a fair kerfuffle about it, I can tell you. I don't think he had their total support. And then he goes on and said, eventually they agreed on the basis, or if I really pulled his ears in about trying to push the pass. Sideline to that, my door nearly got kicked off its hinges when Hetherington found out he wasn't selected. The door burst open and in he came. I thought he was going to pick me up and drop me on my head. But anyway, I sat him down and jumped all over him and said, if you don't shut up, you won't get on at all. But so it was a clear game plan that Sheens wanted to use his ability to offload, and he actually switched Nagus and Ndruku as a part of that plan. And there was a real idea in his head that was just pulled off to absolute perfection.
That there is an example of how is this guy underrated as a coach. Yeah. That is a literal masterstroke and a gamble.
Yeah.
If that failed, he would have been his career would have been over pretty
much. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, for anyone who doesn't know the story, so not long after that Martin Bella drop, Osborne, you know, takes the ball up, gives a beautiful offload to David Ferner to go over for Canberra's first try.
Textbook offload.
Does the same thing about 15 minutes later from about 40 metres out, gives the ball to Ken Nagus, who's off, scores, does all but take the game out of Canterbury's hands in that moment. And as Sheen said, a few minutes after that, Osborne tried to push another pass. The ball went down, Canterbury recovered, and a large hook came onto the field and got him off.
The commentators were saying, do you leave him on or do you stick to the 20 minutes original game plan? And they all unanimously said, you've got to stick with the 20-minute game plan.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I think it was Gould that was the one who came out and said that.
Yeah. just absolutely. He won the grand final for him.
Yeah, yeah,
and it's magical.
Yeah, absolutely was. And in the aftermath, so obviously John Lomax was a very disappointed figure, missing the game. There's all, you know, the classic story of Laurie Daly telling him to get on stage to get a medal, and they won't take it off him. but seeing Lomax and Osborne arm in arm, like, you know, celebrating the victory together, really special moment.
Yeah, I feel bad for John, but in the enforcer business, that's what happens.
Yeah.
But, like, let's talk about Osborne's play there. Watching it back, what I was angry about at the time was he was known for having been so slow at, in the game that passed him by. The old rugby league trope, he was running on the same blade of grass up and down. But in this grand final, in the first 20 there, he was fluid and he was quick.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing is how much that performance harkened back to the old school. When you hear players of the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, they love a ball-playing front rower like Joey loves late footwork. But this quote by Frank Hyde really kind of sums up the way all of these blokes feel about like front row play. On some afternoons these days on which I see a game loaded with hit-ups, I mourn for the skills of a Harry Barth or a Brian McTeague. In their own way, such men were poetry in motion. Today, the forward skills are limited to glimpses. In the 1994 Grand Final, Canberra's Paul Osborne, who only got a game through sheer chance, put on two tries with beautiful passes and was duly struck off the club's books. Osborne's effort in chopping up Canterbury with old-fashioned ball-playing skill was a lovely piece of rugby league nostalgia.
Yeah, it was.
And Osborne, like, took it in good humour. Like, you know, Tim Sheen's in that big league video. Tim Sheen said that Ozzy will, you know, call himself the grand final hero and, you know, talk himself up. But in reality, you know, this is a lot closer to his actual thoughts. So this was from a match report in the Herald after the grand final. A lot of blokes running around, superstars and internationals, haven't played in a grand final. I'm just a nobody and I've won one.
Well, that's a bit harsh because he wasn't a nobody. He's a very good prop. Nice humility there. But the guy's in grand final folklore, in the top three, four, five moments in grand final folklore.
And again, I feel it's a way underrated grand final moment.
It was tighter. I think.
I think that's the other issue.
But either way, he won the game for them.
Yeah. Mm. So let's spend a couple of minutes talking about Paul Osborne's post football life.
Well, aren't we supposed to celebrate the guy?
Very, very interesting career. Started out as an ACT politician, roped his old captain Mal into the game. Didn't last too long. But just a little, when I was looking at his political career, one standout for me was he was running an independent and backed a liberal woman who got in as premier. And she later got into trouble or, you know, lost her job or whatever, because a Bruce Stadium scandal.
I remember this.
So there was a refurbishment of the stadium that was supposed to cost $27 million, half of it paid by private money. It blew out to end up costing $87 million, all paid for by the government.
Even in rugby league excess, I think it's a few kickbacks in there.
And then went on to take the top job at the Eels, where at a dural Woolworths, he was handed a fine by the police for failing to pay for his items at the self-check.
Now, I've laughed at this so hard in my time, right? But we don't know that it was a legitimate mistake because I walk around like a zombie half the time.
I think there's no doubt it was a legitimate mistake.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just funny because he's the CEO of a club.
Yeah, yeah. Like, wearing his Eels, you know, polo at the time.
But the problem is, I think about that as much as I think about the grand final. Yeah.
And then he ended up resigning his post over financial mismanagement at the Eels, which he actually was cleared of any, you know, of any intentional wrongdoing, but
so it's just unintentional incompetence.
Yeah, basically this statement kind of sums up why he lost his job. So one of the club's directors, Glenn Duncan, was also the boss of Pertec, who was their sponsor at the time. He quit the board because they failed to take action over Paul Osborne. And it said, Mr. Duncan had been concerned at allegations of financial irregularities associated with Mr. Osborne's conduct. They included a $35,000 bill on Osborne's club credit card and the fact that the accounts department had to chase him for the repayment of $9,500 in money he had collected from the sale of club jerseys. The club's chairman, Roy Spagnolo, became embroiled in the affair when it was revealed that he had personally loaned Mr. Osborne a large sum of money. That money had not been repaid, and Mr. Spagnolo had failed to disclose the debt to the board when it was deliberating on Mr. Osborne's future.
I mean, how murky is that?
Yeah, very murky. So he was cleared, but resigned his post. And
how was he cleared? I'd rather not even talk about it, because that era of Parramatta administration is just the poster boy for terrible rugby league administrations.
Yeah. Yeah, that bright new day that Dennis Fitzgerald's removal was going to bring in.
I always think of like these like long-term sponsors of basket case clubs, like what that does to their brand and what they get out of paying all this money. But when I think of Pertec, I don't think, what a great company. I think, oh, geez, that Parramatta.
But back to the game itself. So the flip side for Paul Osborne was Scott Wilson, the Canterbury fullback, who ended up being dragged after 30 minutes.
So sad.
So sad. And like, it wasn't a Steve Maven or Marvin type performance from Wilson. Like, he dropped a couple of balls, but I think Daryl Halligan was at least as bad.
He had that image, see? The party boy, blonde, brain explosion, flamboyant player. Mm. So when he drops the ball, it gets magnified.
Yeah.
And the balls he dropped was swirling torpedo bombs that you'd be lucky to catch on a good day.
And it's so funny, like, one moment, like, basically derailed his career. Like, he was cut from Canterbury, played, another, 2 or 3 years at, I think, Gold Coast, and where do you go? Went Gold Coast, Reds, and Cowboys.
Well, in the previous ep, we talked about Jason Taylor having the bad rap because of the resting bitch face.
Yeah.
Male version. Scotty Wilson had the bad rap for being the party boy.
Mm. But yeah, so just those little moments, the way they can just reshape a player's, fortunes, just one game. I guess that's the nature of it, isn't it?
It is, yeah. That's why winners win, losers lose, to quote 50 Cent.
let's talk about the Clive Churchill medal. So, not Paul Osborne, although, he gave it a real shot. But so, David Ferner got it.
Who else do you think had a shot?
So,
I think Noah had a shot.
I think, so, Don Ferner, who was one of the judges of the Clive Churchill Award.
Is that the most appropriate thing?
No, it's not. And so he actually voted for Steve Walters because he didn't want the accusation of nepotism. But it's like, why not recuse yourself from voting when you know that your son is playing in the game and take away those, it's just so weird to me that he would like compromise the vote, to get away from nepotism when like...
Insane.
But I got to say, I think Steve Walters would have been a good choice. I thought he had a very good game.
As always with Steve, Boxer Walters, he was in the top few players.
Mm.
But I think they got it right, to be honest.
I think they got it right too. Like, in a game with no like obvious standout, I think he was the closest thing to a standout.
Yeah, great player, man.
As we talked about in our discussion of the Canberra squad, there remains to this day a perception that one good game put him on the plane to England, when the reality is that he'd been solidly building a case for himself all year. And in the grand final coverage, there was actually quite a bit of talk during the game that, he was a key, keen contender for a kangaroo spot.
My thoughts on Ferner is the Croker-Ferner thing can be debated for 100 more years, and they both wouldn't have been out of place. We know that. But Ferner offered more against the Brits with that footwork.
Yeah.
And the goal kicking, it's just more of a handful than Croker.
Mm.
So if it was going to be a tie, I think they got it right.
Yeah.
Even for that.
I can't argue with that. And yeah, so Croker at that stage of his career could do a lot of things very well, but he didn't necessarily have anything that would strike fear into the England team, where I think Ferner did have that little edge there.
Yeah.
And the other, I guess, main talking point of the game was sending Mal out a winner, which Canberra duly did. The ease with which they did win that game left somewhat of an empty feeling within Mal, who said at the end of the game that he felt kind of empty, like it was just a bit of an anti-climax.
Perfect. Never ask Mal for a quote, because like, they're always terrible. Every big moment, he's been asked for a quote. It's been, what?
Yeah, so this was his exact quote. "It's strange, but I feel empty. We won so easily, didn't we? It's hard to get excited about it. A bit of an anti-climax, really."
Cheers.
I thought it was a really nice moment during the presentation with Terry Lamb on the stage, honouring Mal Meninga. And when you think about those two blokes, like the amount of time they'd been around, like both more or less starting at the same time around 1980, think about like how different the game was over the course of those 14 years.
It's astounding when you think about it.
Whereas now, like, you look back at 2005, like, that could be last year or the year before. Like, it feels like the change from 80 to 1994 was, like, exponential.
Well, when you think about this as well, 94, they were semi-professional still, right? No, not everyone was professional.
No, yeah.
So Mal would have been, but he's now, you know, the master coach of Queensland. But he finished playing when they were still training like three times a
week.
Amazing.
Yeah. And to, you know, tease next week's episode a little bit, that's going to be a major point of discussion as we look at the growth of the game in the Winfield Cup era that, you know, indirectly led to Super League. The changes that were ratcheted in over that decade were really, you know, astounding in terms of rugby league, especially with it's, as we've spoken about, the inability to, you know, achieve cultural change in rugby league. The powers that be in the 80s did a lot that, you know, kind of led to Super League.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the presentation a bit more. Did you have any other highlights from that?
No, I just love the old presentations.
One thing that like struck me, like Richard Wilkins as MC, like what was he doing anywhere near the stage? I know he was like, you know, the go-to guy, but
he was like, you know, he was on the way up, young and cool back then.
Yeah, I really, really cast a shadow over the proceedings for me.
I like Richard Wilkins. like my favorite thing from old presentations, Origins, Test, Grand Finals, is the old club official, the Brill Crint official,
yeah,
with the blazer, you know, and the club tie, etc. The best.
Ken Arthurson's readiness to praise Winfield, like he just will insert a Winfield like comment into anywhere he can get it.
It's hard to judge someone on a different era, but looking back and you sit a cigarette shilling, it's despicable.
Yeah, yeah.
It really, like it just puts a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah.
Anyhow, have a Winfield.
Speaking of Winfield and the Winfield Cup more specifically, it was in a Peter Fitzsimons column where he noted this, and watching it in the presentation was really striking to me. The lack of a base on the Winfield Cup, like when Mal lifted it, it was just this like hollow underside. It's like it couldn't be that hard to like put a base on your trophy.
We're forever having trophy problems in rugby league.
I loved the post-match interviews, Laurie Daly in particular, where he was being interviewed by Tim Sheridan, and his eyes are just darting from side to side for the duration of the interview. He didn't look at Sheridan or the camera once. it was classic Laurie, like very excitable. And
but how far has he come from, you know, the naive country boy to the media analyst he is today? I wanted to bring up that the differential now between grand final rings, aka American style, versus the old grand final medal.
Yeah,
which is basically like the bicentennial medal from school. In some sort of cheap red case.
I miss that, actually. I find the rings just a bit too American.
Yeah, right. It was very Aussie, the medal, that's for sure.
Well, let's talk about the party, because I think it would have been a fairly sedate one as far as grand final parties go.
Well, as Mal said, how could you get excited?
Yeah. So some good stories from the party, though, with Ricky Stewart left stranded, you know, in the early hours of the morning, having to get to the airport to make his plane to Sydney for the Kangaroo Tour.
I mean, do they need to have the Kangaroo Tour thing the day after the grand final?
It's crazy that they play a grand final, they celebrate, and they're expected to be on a plane to England like 12 hours later. Like the squads, they don't even have time to pack their bags. They name the squad after the grand final. Any selected player has to just pack his bags and hightail it to the airport instantly.
The scheduling.
So, yeah, so he ended up having to get some journalists who were on the scene to give him a lift to the airport to make his flight.
No rugby league player is ever short of a lift. There's always someone flagging down someone, running into someone.
Luke DiVico wasn't expected to play that day, so he actually decided to head to the game with his mates in a minibus. So, you know, all the boys were there. They were going to watch the game together. Luke DiVico at one point thought he'd go down to the sheds to wish the team luck, and you know, and Tim Sheen saw him and said, "Luke, why aren't you in uniform?" Because he was in the extended squad.
All right.
And then so he had to kit up, and then he was on the field like, you know, doing warm ups with the team. So his mates were all in the stands going, "Oh, there's Luke."
So what would have happened if he didn't bump into him, Sheen's?
Yeah.
He's like, "Where's DiVico?" he's in row G.
So you know, as I said, the party went long into the night. Laurie Daly made up his own version of the tune Yankee Doodle Dandy, which the actual lyrics of his version haven't been printed. But so they had, you know, some good proceedings. But as I said, I don't think it would have been up there with some of the great grand final winning parties.
So the highlight of it was Laurie Daly making up a parody song to Yankee Doodle
Dandy. Yeah, so that kind of tells you that, you know, that it wasn't the most exciting party.
It's really actually put a damper on this chat that Mal Meninga wasn't that thrilled about it. So if we've got out a winner after having the greatest career of all time. You're on your fourth kangaroo show.
Well, I think that's the other thing. Like, he did have a plane to catch the next morning. You know, the career was over, but in a sense, like, in a time when being the Australian captain, going on your fourth kangaroo tour meant something historic, like, you could see that it was, you know, maybe understand why it was kind of anticlimactic to finish your grade career.
Yeah, fair enough. Annoying to me, though.
Where would you rank the grand final parties? Just think of maybe since 89 on. Which do you think
I was in Newcastle in 97. I was turning 17, 18, and that was absolutely incredible.
So for me, that and Panthers 91, that's 1A and 1B. Knowing the cast of characters involved in each of those teams, what it meant to those communities, I think those would have been about the best ones.
But how can you beat Joey Johns with the jester hat on the skateboard?
Yeah, yeah, that's you know, rocking up at Daniel Johns' house and singing Freak, you know. Yeah, that's pretty unassailable.
I mean, it wasn't there, honestly, but 89 Canberra must have been up there.
Yeah. I think probably 2016 Sharks would have been up there as well in terms of more modern ones.
I'm surprised anyone turned up. They don't turn up down there. I mean, nothing's going to beat burning down the grandstand at Parramatta.
Yeah, yeah.
Arson.
All right, so for every party, there's a meeting. So let's talk about Canterbury. And again, not the most heartbreaking loss when it was so emphatic. But the funny thing is there was a lot of talk from Canterbury how confident they were on the day. And that's the funny thing about hindsight, where, you know, we can read all these accounts from Canberra going, we knew we weren't going to lose.
There's just some key moments. I mean, yeah. And I think it's actually, there's no disgrace in being blown off the park by a team that can blow teams off the park.
Mm.
Almost better than losing close.
Yeah.
Because they were blown off the park in the first 20 minutes, it was over. But we go back to the Mal knocking out Lamb. He's their rugby league trophy. He's their talisman.
Yeah. I mean, and there's no guarantee that they were going to go on and win the next year, you know. But it counts for something having that experience and getting up there. And you went from Terry Lamb being the only player in the team with grand final experience to now most of the team having that.
Yeah, for sure.
So, and that's how it played out. I want to talk now about the legacy of that Canberra squad, you know. So we can think of them as a historic team. They had a quarter of the Kangaroo squad that year with three or four players unlucky to not make the team.
Yeah, yeah.
So my first question is, did they do enough?
In what way?
In only winning that one comp. I mean, you can call it three comps if you want to group it as one era.
No, it's a different era.
I think it's a different era too.
93, we've been through it in the previous episodes. They would have won it, most likely. Or at least give it a good shake, if not for the injury to Stewart. Can't blame him for that. 95, I don't know what happened.
Mm.
And it was over.
Like, they lost, what, like four games or something regular season? They were, you know.
It was just, it was a grand final hangover is what it was.
Yeah, yeah. But, so on the one hand, it shows you how hard it is to win back-to-back.
Well, I know what happened. The Kangaroo Tour wouldn't have helped.
No.
Can you go and play an extra 16 games?
Yeah, yeah.
And then come back and defend your comp.
But I think it's a legitimate question in terms of their legacy as one of the great teams, which, when you look at their 94 form, when you look at that team on paper, it's easy to say they're one of the great teams. But did they do enough to deserve?
I think so. Just everyone knows. You look at it and you know, like, so Jonathan Thurston won one comp, really, with North Queensland. But they'll look at that as like, oh, it's a great grand final. Mm. What a great team. What a great player. It's only one comp. And then the Canterbury one, obviously. But you ask anybody in rugby league, teams of the 90s, I'll say 94 Raiders, 92 Broncos.
I do think, though, they needed to go on with it to elevate themselves from a great team in their era to one of the great teams. Like, I don't think you can say it's a historic team, like you might talk about South of the 20s, East of the 30s, so on and so on.
Historic in terms of, you know, records accumulated in comps won, no. But historic in, like, best squads. Mm. We'll talk about it during the series, but 95 was a write-off, just hangover.
Yeah.
Then Super League comes in. Mm. 96 and 97, very disruptive.
Yeah.
So who knows what would have happened.
It does make it hard to weigh it up, as we spoke about in our prelude to this season. Mm. So 89 to 91, very little turnover in those teams. So you can consider that one team, one era.
Yeah.
And then 94, the second era. Do you think 94 is the better team?
See, that's the thing. They've got a better record in the first incarnation, but it's a much better team in 94.
I think the competition they had was bigger in 94. You know, I think there were better teams than that first Canberra team had to play against.
Absolutely. Basically an Australian side.
Yeah.
With a few Kiwi internationals.
Yeah. Like when you look at that 89 team, even though you had the same nucleus and some other, the likes of Chica Ferguson, Dean Lance.
Matthew Wood, Gary Coyne.
Yeah. So I think on balance, the 94 team's a much better team. I'd give it to them.
Use the word balance. It was so well balanced.
Mm.
You had strike everywhere.
Yeah.
No weak links.
But so you say it was a balanced squad, and yeah, it was. Like they wouldn't have been able to do what they did without dominant forwards. But as we said a couple of episodes ago, when you think about that team, it is the back line that you think about first. So I wanted to spend a bit of time as we finish just weighing up that back line against some other great back lines. So the first thing I wanted to have a look at was all international back lines. So Brett Mullins, Ken Nagus, Mel Meninga, Ruben Wiki, Noah Nendroku, Laurie Daly and Ricky Stewart. So you had Mullins, Meninga, Wiki, Daly and Stewart, all current internationals in 1994. Nagus played later in 97. Noah Nendroku played for Fiji in 1995. Mm-hmm. So an all international back line, but not all current international back lines. And I've tried to find an example of an all current international back line and I haven't been able to. So you had some near misses with those Broncos squads of the 90s. So 98, Darren Lockyer, Michael Hancock, who you could sub in for Mick DeVere, Steve Renoff, Darren Smith, who you could sub in for Tony Carroll, Wendell Saylor, Kevin Walters and Alan Langer. So very loaded team there.
Yeah.
But again, so a couple of those players were future internationals, not current.
But we need to judge these backlines on how they were playing in that
year. Yeah.
Not all over career.
Yeah. So I agree with that. I think 1994 Canberra, I think...
Well, honestly, I think 98 gives it a run for its money.
I think actually maybe the early 90s one when it was so stacked that you had Wally Lewis and Gene Miles both playing in the forwards.
Yeah.
So 1990, Paul Hough, Michael Hancock, Peter Jackson, Chris Johns, Willie Kahn, Kevin Walters, Alan Langer.
I think the other one's better.
91, Dale Shearer, Michael Hancock, Steve Renoff, Chris Johns, Willie Kahn, Kevin Walters, Alan Langer.
That's like, probably up there, yeah.
That's, you know, there's some class teams. As I said last week, we're going to source some information and some stats from friend of the show, Andrew Ferguson, as often as we can because we really need all the help we can get. So I want to lean on his knowledge and experience whenever we can. So he threw up some other great backlines. So some early ones, East in 1908 and 1913, when you had the likes of Dan Frawley, Dally Messenger, Albert Rosenfeld, you know, Les Cubitt, Arthur Halloway. So a couple of stacked teams there. Go on to North Sydney in 1922, where you had Ted Taplin, Cess Blinkhorn, Herman Peters, Frank Rule, Harold Horder, Dallas Hodgins, and Duncan Thompson. Again, with those teams, you're seeing some all-time greats with some players that we don't know as much about now. And I think maybe when you look at 94 Raiders, that's kind of going to be true when you had like blokes like Nandruku, Nagus, Wiki, who had a great career, great Hall of Fame career. He was only young, and you don't really think of him as like a center as much as you do in the later part of his career.
So this is my point about you're saying it's, and you're correct, that everybody thinks of it as a backline team, but they were very young. And it was considered, it was actually more a forward team.
Yeah.
It was a halves team,
yeah,
but everything was built from the forwards.
Mm. Yeah.
You take Ponga and Lomax out of that side and look out.
And I think that's when you go to St. George 1964, when you had, as we talked about in the last episode, Graham Langlands, Johnny King, Reg Gasnier, Billy Smith, Eddie Lumsden, Brian Clay, George Evans. And then you look at the forwards they had as well, Johnny Raper, Kevin Ryan, Ian Walsh at hooker, Norm Proven, etc., etc. So,
well, speaking of hookers, somehow he's still underrated. Steve Walters.
Yeah.
Now, this was at his peak of his powers, 94 Kangaroo Tour. It was at the absolute peak of his powers. Revolutionized the hooking role to become hooker forward before it was like Tony Ray types.
Yeah. We've underrated him. We've barely talked about him in four episodes and talking about this Canberra team.
Yeah, I don't know why we've done that. It's just something that slides under the radar.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I didn't underrate him at the time. He was in my top three players.
Mm.
As I said, stop the Saab to sign the cards at Marathon. That's a stand-up guy. But he revolutionized the position.
Yeah.
And 94, Tangaroo Tour, which we'll get to, beautiful.
So peak Steve Walters, but also Steve Walters very near the edge of the cliff too. Like it was...
Yeah.
One thing I want to shout out as potentials in terms of when we're looking back at legacy, I think we've had two potentially all-time backlines in the last couple of years. Like look at the Roosters last year. James Tedesco, Daniel Tupou, Latrell Mitchell, Joseph Manu, Blake Ferguson, Luke Keary, Cooper Cronk.
See, that... is in the same position as Canberra in that Manu and Luttrell are very young.
Yeah.
But when they retire.
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to be looked back upon as immortals, probably.
I think that's a back line that maybe in 10 years or so, if the careers pan out the way we're thinking of, that people will go, wow, that was a loaded team.
Well, I'll just say this. I was looking at Steve Smith's stats a couple of years ago thinking, this guy's going to be one of the all-time great stats. Next thing you know, so don't count your chickens.
And the same year, just the year before, Melbourne Storm 2017, Billy Slater, Suliasi Vunivalu, Will Chambers, Curtis Scott, Josh Adokar, Cameron Munster, Cooper Cronk.
I don't think it's in the same class as...
I think Curtis Scott kind of has gone off the boil this year, but he was tracking that way. I think having Slater and Cronk there, plus Cameron Munster at a time when he was starting to become really ascendant, I think it's another one that could be looked at in a few years a bit differently to now.
It's just you look at the Raiders, you had Mullins in his peak year doing some of the best things we've seen in 100 years of football. Then you had the halves, who were two of the best ever, and then probably the best combination ever. Mal, like, still doing it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So as we finish up, and we are, you know, finally going to be in some way talking about Super League in the episodes going forward, I think this series of episodes was really important in setting up Super League, partly to give you the context of Rugby League in 1994. But when you think about how many of the people we've talked about are key players in Super League, and you wouldn't have had Super League having the impact it did if you didn't have, like, Daly and Stewart, like, you know, right in the thick of it, you know, signing, you know, from the start. Like, I think it's easy for younger rugby league fans to discount, you know, a career like Ricky Stewart's because he's seen, you know, immortals come since. But it's important to remember how good these players were and how, like, how high they descended in 1994.
Absolutely. But if you went to any of these recent immortals' careers or soon to be immortals like Thurston and said, just when you're hitting your peak of your powers, can we just have a civil war in the game?
Yeah, exactly. So do you have any closing thoughts on this Canberra team that I know, you know, holds strong memories for you?
In my lifetime, it's my favourite football team ever, club football team. And I think many people across the game feel the same way. It's just, it was a magical time in the game.
Yeah, no doubt. And I hope we've conveyed that over these last four episodes. 1994 really was a fantastic year for rugby league. I don't think that's just us giving our own rose-coloured memories of childhood. I think it was, you know, watching these highlights, which you can see many of on YouTube, it was a really exciting time for on-field, along with everything else that was going on. So it will quickly deteriorate from there going into season 1995, which we'll be covering in detail. But next week's episode, we're actually going to be going back to the start, looking at the rise of rugby league in the Ken Arthurson era, so from taking over from Kevin Humphries in 1983, looking at those changes that came into the game and how much better placed rugby league was in 1994 than it had been a decade earlier. So as I said, we'll be back next week with that. Would love to hear your thoughts. Send us an email to therugbyleaguedigest@gmail.com. Hit us up on Facebook and Twitter, and we will speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.